From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Blockchain, it's the platform that Bitcoin runs on. So what's the basic premise? It's a decentralized ledger system that keeps track of data points, or blocks, in real time. Advocates for the emerging platform say it allows for personal transactional control over information shared on the blockchain. The cryptography, or code, underlying the platform is called by some experts as unhackable, as it alerts users to inconsistencies in the ledger. While blockchain is used in financial markets and has created new possibilities for transferring value, blockchain is also making inroads into other business sectors, medical records, cybersecurity, and government accountability. Our task today is to begin to understand the implications of this new technology, the challenges for regulatory agencies, traditional financial institutions, and what possibilities advocates for this technology and vision. With us on this Thursday, Brennan Bennett, Chief Operating Officer for Qubrix, an enterprise blockchain platform. Welcome to Coastline, Brennan Bennett.
Thank you.
Gerard Daché is the president of the Government Blockchain Association, a global nonprofit that connects individuals, businesses, and government entities to blockchain applications. Welcome, Gerard Daché.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
Also with us today, Lucas Lehman, an assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Lucas Lehman, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
We are, of course, inviting you to join the conversation. What would you like to know about blockchain? Have you traded Bitcoin? What's your experience with the platform? You can tell us about it on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Lucas Lehman, for those folks who just heard that introduction and still have no idea what I'm talking about when I say blockchain, how would you describe it?
So blockchain is a way to keep track of events or records. So for example, say I want to transfer $50 from me to you. I send that transaction to the blockchain, and a group of other people who we call peers look at that transaction and say, is it valid? Does Lucas have $50 to give to Rachel? If so, then they work to add it to what is called a ledger, which is our block in the blockchain. And these blocks are all tied together. So the current block depends on the previous block using sophisticated computer science and cryptographic techniques. And the way that they are tied together means that once a record of a transaction is in the block, it cannot be altered. And if it is, or someone attempts to alter it, the rest of the world, the rest of the network immediately knows.
And that's basically why it's supposed to be so much more secure than current and past models.
Yes. So the process and responsibility for verifying that a transaction is valid belongs to a group of people, not any one person. And that is truly where it diverges from, say, a traditional banking system where you go up to the teller and withdraw some cash, and you hope that the bank keeps your records safe and secure. Whereas in the blockchain, once it's out there and distributed amongst these trusted enemies, whether there are other people in the public or other corporations, that record is out there, and it's very difficult, if not impossible, to tamper with it.
Gerard Daché, Government Blockchain Association, you have sort of a unique way of explaining to folks what blockchain is from where you sit. How would you describe it?
Well, I want to just add Lucas's explanation, I think, was spot on. But I'd like to sort of add what that means, kind of thing. So when the Internet first came out, you know, there were some people that said, hey, I think we can move information from point A to point B without going through a third party, like a newspaper, radio, U.S. Postal Service, television station. And that simple idea, which initially really looked like file transfers and email, eventually got to the point where we could jump into a stranger's car, go across town, go into a stranger's house, sleep in their bed, and then use our phones to swipe right or left to determine who we're going to marry, right? The impact of what Lucas said is mind-boggling, right? It's kind of like where the internet was in 1994, where we have a basic understanding of the technology and we can see limited use cases like email and file transfers. But where this thing is going is totally up to the imagination.
And the Harvard Business Review actually agrees with that assessment. I think they said something about how blockchain will eventually have this cascade of change to our current culture the way e-commerce did in the 1990s.
Yeah, I think that when Harvard and many of these prestigious universities agree with anything I have to say, it adds credibility to them.
Brennan Bennett of Qubrix, from where you sit, we've talked about blockchain as being the platform underneath Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, but there are other ways that Qubrix implements this technology.
Absolutely. We see it forward thinking, where cryptocurrency isn't necessarily the driver. We're focused on the enterprise space, so specifically permissioned and hybrid systems that use both public and private blockchain technologies to transfer value, build consortiums, and secure data like never before. The flexibility is really where we're looking at it from a future standpoint.
So give us some examples of how that might be done.
Absolutely. So my background, healthcare, for example. Healthcare is deeply divided and fractured at this point. So being able to move medical records from an individual from the entire point of care to the clinical chain of custody, also to be able to share data between divisions of an enterprise healthcare company that otherwise would be separate from a regulatory standpoint. Blockchain allows the enterprise the ability to scrub data and move data, but still validate data in a way that it is can move quicker, faster, and in a more immutable fashion than traditional legacy systems. So being able primarily to cut down redundancies is the big thing that blockchain offers. For example, identity verification for a medical record, instead of having to re-verify that identity, refill out that paperwork that you have to fill out every single time you go to a new hospital, a new pharmacy or whatever, being able to cut that down and reduce business processes, create automation, but in a more secure fashion, in a more interoperable fashion.
You talk about security, and as a layperson thinking about my medical records being accessible through any pharmacy that I might walk into or any medical office that I might enter, it sounds to me like there's more sharing going on, and so it's less secure. It's out there more and not kept within, say, a local network of healthcare providers.
Sure, that's a fair point. Where that comes into play is, at least from a Qubrix standpoint, is looking at access control. Being able to control the access for whoever needs to see it, for whoever living a limited amount of time they need to see it. And that can either, at this point, be controlled by the individual. Ideally, in the future, if we go back to the enterprise play, being able to ensure that that access is guaranteed ahead of time. So instead of being able to just hand off the records to one legacy system to another, being able to control who can access them regardless of what legacy system they're in. So the idea is for blockchain not to replace legacy systems, but to augment the security and access control in a way that you can control that type of exact same question, making sure that nobody can get in there without your permission, without a doctor's permission, provider's permission, and whatnot.
Now, we're going to take a deeper dive into the security element of it in a little while. But first, I want to kind of explore some more potential applications for this technology. Someone had mentioned that this is even possible, Gerard Dashé, to change the way we vote and keep voting records more secure.
Right. In fact, if you go to the gbaglobal.org website, we have a voting working group. It's headed by a guy out on the West Coast. They've got a company called Voterfied, but it's a place where all of the folks that are interested in the voting space can come together. And the applications within voting are cool, but even more so how democracy is done, right? But I'll come back to voting. So the nice thing about voting in the blockchain is when somebody cast a vote, it's a record, it's immutable, everybody knows it, everybody sees it. It would kind of be like this. If I had a room filled with 30 people and I said, here's how we're going to vote. Everybody write down your vote on whether or not I'm the most handsome guy in the world, yes or no, right? And they all write their vote, then they give it to my friend or they give it to somebody, and that friend counts it, right? And they say, you know what? 97% says Gerard's the most handsome guy in the world. That's one way to do it. That's the way we do it now, right?
And that sounds like an absolutely plausible number, by the way.
Yes. Well, thank you. You are wiser than I even thought.
You're underestimating.
I love all of you. But the blockchain way of doing it is a little different. It says to the 30 people, hey, fill out your vote, make 30 copies of your vote, give them to everyone else, and then we can all count it ourselves. So then we all know exactly what the vote tallies are. And it's instead of
So if I'm one of those 30 people then, and I'm one of the people able to count the vote tallies, can I also see how you voted?
It all depends on how you set up sort of the permissions and the access, right? So there's a couple ways to do it. The way one of the systems works is if you vote, you can instantly see that vote appear on the blockchain. So that means everybody else can instantly see it. But you don't know whose vote is associated to who. It also connects to the voter registration rolls. So the key is to take these technologies, integrate them into existing technologies and systems, but create a better way. And if you do that, you disintermediate that entire government function. And there are many government functions that may be totally disintermediated because we can find new ways to do it.
And when we come back, I want to hear you talk about how this could affect the way democracy works. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're learning about blockchain, a decentralized ledger technology. We have two blockchain experts with us and a UNCW assistant professor of computer science. We're taking your questions. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. If you have questions about how this technology could impact your life or how it works, you can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're exploring how blockchain, a distributed ledger technology, could create a cascade of effects on modern life, analogous to the changes e-commerce has brought since the 1990s. That's a conclusion drawn by the Harvard Business Review. Here to help us explore these implications and the still unanswered questions, Lucas Lehman, assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, Gerard Daché, president of the Government Blockchain Association, a global nonprofit advocating for blockchain solutions, and Brennan Bennett, the chief operating officer of Qubrix. They're taking your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. We have an email from Nick asking about security with cryptocurrency, so we're going to start unpacking that in a little while because there have been so many headlines around those issues. But first, Gerard Daché, you said not only could this technology transform the way we vote, but it could also change the way democracy works. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a candidate in California, in the North San Diego district recently, and his platform was direct democracy, right? A guy by the name of Michael Allman. And while I don't think he won the seat, this was his platform, and this is kind of the things we're starting to see. His commitment was to put all of his votes on the blockchain, right, and to allow his constituents to vote issue by issue, because about a third of his district was a Republican, about a third were Democrat, and about a third were in the middle. And so there is no, you know, it's not like everybody believes, you know, whether it's social issues or economic issues. His folks are kind of all over the map. Right, they don't follow the standard Republican Democrat.
He was running as an independent candidate.
No, he was running as a Republican, but what he said was, "Look, my constituents can vote issue by issue, and I will vote in Congress the way my constituents do." So when you know Paul Ryan or the head of whoever the Republican Party comes in with the NRA and says, "Hey, listen, Michael, we expect you to vote for this issue. He pulls out his phone. He looks at how his voters are voting on that issue, and he says, "Listen, I got some good news and some bad news. Right? The bad news is my constituents aren't up with you, so I can't vote that way. The good news is I've only got 11% of the vote in on that. So if you take that money and spend it in my district and convince them, then I'm all in." So it's a way of taking the money and the power that concentrates in Washington and distributes it back out to the people and creates greater accountability so that the voters can see to what degree Mike's votes would line up with theirs. And one of the things that he said that was striking was, and I think he said it was in California, there's two senators. One's a Republican, one's a Democrat. One of them votes straight Republican and the other one votes straight Democrat, right? Well, they both are representing the same state. So how could that be? And it's because there's so much in Washington at the congressional level that is driven by the party as opposed to decentralizing that and kind of taking it issue by issue and pulling the money and the power and I think the fighting and the divisiveness away from Washington. And there's many others. We have in the area of financial integrity, we have a budget appropriations and tracking working group, and they're looking at how can we have greater transparency in the money that comes in, how it's managed, and accountability of that.
So the money that comes into what? A political organization?
No, to a government.
A governmental
right,
organization.
So the money that's collected via taxes, right, we ought to be able to see on a blockchain, we ought to be able to vote on a blockchain priorities, right? And then we ought to be able to see through smart contracts that money is being spent. And if one of the things that's really great about this technology is you can program logic directly into the money. So if you program the logic directly in the money and the money goes in that route, then it reduces the opportunities for fraud and corruption and auditing. It makes it way more efficient, greater transparency and integrity and trust in government. There's an all-time low in the trust in government.
Yes.
And this technology essentially would give us greater transparency.
Well, let's talk about the control of blockchain. I think that's something we touched on a little bit in the first segment, how it's decentralized. And that's part of what makes it more secure, because people can see inconsistencies then in the blockchain. But who owns it? Who owns blockchain? Brennan Bennett.
Sure.
No, Brennan Bennett does not own blockchain.
No. It's a relative question. When you're talking about public chains, Bitcoin and whatnot, I mean, there are core development teams that own the upgrades, enhancements, and whatnot. But at the end of the day, you can't make major upgrades, forks, splits, whatever, without a consensus vote. That changes a little bit when you look at permission and hybrid chains. Obviously, an enterprise is going to own a permission chain. And they're going to have control over the consensus and whatnot, but that's because it's business. It's not because it's public. So to answer the question, you know, it is up to the constituents of the chain itself, being that depending upon how it works from an engineering perspective, the nodes or oracles, how the voting rights work and whatnot. So, you know, it's everybody and nobody at the same time.
Yeah, it's just like the internet, right? Who owns
much.
The internet, right? Everybody owns a piece, and all those pieces connect together, and it's the connection that forms
exactly
the whole thing.
Except it's the only difference it would make is that it's not run through an ISP. So it's not run through your provider isn't going to control your access, you know, and who I was going to see. As long as you can get access to it, which is then you're part of the ownership.
Okay, so speaking of ownership and control and access, there is another platform, EOS. Is that something that would run on the blockchain platform, or is that a competing technology? Brennan Bennett.
From what I understand, I'm not too familiar with the intricacies and the absolute technical details. From what I understand, it's a competing technology or competing blockchain protocol that is evolved, just like Ethereum had evolved from Bitcoin. EOS is evolving, which is due in part to its I do remember it has a prolonged ICO. It does have substantial funding. It does have substantial traction.
When you say IEO, that's initial coin offering.
ICO, yeah. So I do recall that they've raised a substantial amount of money to move forward with their technology innovation. But again, going back to Ethereum was an evolution from Bitcoin from a smart contract perspective. And I expect, regardless of the progress of EOS, I expect this to kind of rinse and repeat for the next decade or so as this technology
is
moving.
You mean competing technologies emerging?
Emerging within the blockchain space, yeah. So we look at the math and science behind the underlying tech of blockchain, how rapidly that's moving forward from a computer science perspective. You can do more with less from a voting and perspective. I see this as just a stepping stone to of things to come.
I think it's important to understand, going back to basics, that the blockchain is no one thing. You don't go to your favorite big box store and say, I want the blockchain, please. A blockchain is
owned. You go to the big block store, right? Not the big box store.
He's also the funniest man in America. So how it is used is dependent on who is setting it up. So, for example, the cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum, those are public blockchains. Anyone can contribute. Anyone can participate. There are also things that Brendan has mentioned, hybrid blockchains, permissioned blockchains. And there, that's maybe a group of corporations, a group of government entities, public or private partnerships. And that's where you would put more sensitive things. As you said, you don't put electronic health records out on the public blockchain. You would not want to do that, or certain other things as well.
So then who controls permissions and access?
Well, it depends upon the scenario you're talking to. So Hubrix, that's exactly what we're working on. We're working on technologies that can be deployed with the enterprise from a permission or hybrid perspective. We have that kind of granular access control. An enterprise can set a decentralized access control for an employee all the way up to a division to an executive level and be able to secure the information from point A to point B. From a public perspective, that's different. That's tied to however you access that protocol and access that network. And as it evolves, especially the way we see it moving forward, is that access will be less at the protocol level, but more at the application level, looking at more akin to, an Android-type market where applications as a whole run on blockchain as an underlying tech. And then the ability for people to interact with them becomes a lot more seamless.
And can I just add something?
Sure.
Because I think it's important for the listeners to understand this in terms of some basic concepts. When we say the word blockchain is kind of like the word network, right? There's a lot of different networks, right? And in the early days there were local area networks and wide area networks and stuff. Blockchain is really more of a concept, right? And so there are many different types of blockchain. So people understand about like the Bitcoin blockchain, and the description that we talked about really was around the Bitcoin blockchain because that's what most people are aware of.
Right.
But there are blockchains without any blocks,
yep.
Right? And the Bitcoin blockchain is really awesome. It has some great things about it, but it also has some technical limitations. So there's other technologies and other concepts. There's a blockchain called Tangle, right? There's Hashgraph. There's different – now there's sort of different flavors of the concept of blockchain. And then within those different sort of conceptual design constraints design options, then there are many different companies, right, that are creating and different organizations, associations. So if you go to coinmarket.cap, you'll see on there, I think there's over, 1,500, 2,000? I forgot what the number is.
Lost count.
Different blockchains and coins. And so there is a huge amount of variation in terms of this space. And in all of those, they have to design a governance model to answer your question, who controls access, what's the supply if they're using a cryptocurrency or a token, right? There's a whole governance structure that each one of those blockchains have to decide, voting, how do they make decisions. So there's a lot there.
And to kind of segue on that, the big thing when I talk to enterprises, when I talk to them about their wants and needs and just explaining the technology in general, looking at blockchain as more of a 20% technology, 80% business solution. Worry about your business. It is not a magic fix for everything, but what it can fix really, really well. So if you look at it straight from a business perspective, they can go into that list that Gerard just mentioned, pick out kind of what works best for this business use case, and then come to a company like Hubrix or another consulting company that can come in and patch it together and see build the technologies that work best for your particular business use case.
Right.
You're listening. Hold on one second. You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of blockchain, the platform underlying Bitcoin that goes beyond cryptocurrency applications. Here to answer your questions on this Thursday, Gerard Dashé, president of Government Blockchain Association, a nonprofit. Brennan Bennett, Chief Operating Officer of Qbrix, and Lucas Lehman, Assistant Professor in UNCW's Department of Computer Science. If you have questions about this emerging technology, you can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And I just want to note that if you're listening to the live Thursday show, UNCW's Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship is producing a blockchain-centered event tomorrow, Friday, June 15th. And as I understand, the afternoon portion of it is open to the public. And Lucas Lehman, you're nodding. Are you going to be at that event?
Yes, I believe all three of us will be there.
Excellent.
So if you can't get enough of Gerard's humor today, show up tomorrow.
The funniest and handsomest guy in the world. More than 200 volunteer developers working to launch EOS. Again, this is that competing technology that we talked about. They spent, according to an article in the Wall Street Journal, a fraught 3 hours on a conference call last week arguing about issues related to that platform's launch. A transcript of the call was posted on Reddit, and it shows argument over all kinds of technical issues, big and small. But according to the Wall Street Journal, part of the debate was who would put up the random access memory that was required to run this first. And what they needed was equal to about $260,000. And so there was this debate over, do we go into what they called God mode and create the RAM, or does somebody actually put that money up front? And ultimately, without getting into the minutia of that, they ultimately decided to create it. But then that raises all kinds of potentially, well, ethical questions, really, Gerard Dashé, about, again, permissions, access, who gets to go into God mode, in a sense, in these types of platforms?
Right. So there are hundreds, maybe thousands of different groups like that having those same kind of arguments. So I'm gonna sort of take it up a little bit. One of the things that's really attractive about this space is a decentralized consensus type of decision-making process, right? There are limitations with that in that when you have problems, it's difficult to get a whole bunch of people to come to consensus. So some of the governance models lean very far over towards the distributed consensus, and a lot of the other other governance models lean very much more towards what you refer to as the God mode, right? So we're going to make some of these decisions. And Bitcoin Cash, you know, a lot of these other things that you hear about, what happens is you have a group of developers, right? You have miners. You have a sort of an ecosystem. And sometimes they have a disagreement in terms of, I wouldn't call it ethical. I would call it more philosophical than ethical, right? Some believe we should be more philosophically open. Some believe we should be more command and control. And when they cannot come to an agreement, right, half of them go one way, half of them go the other way, and that's what's referred to as a fork. And when a blockchain or a cryptocurrency forks, then what happens is you now have two separate blockchains that have originally come back from the same source. So many of the fragmenting of these different blockchains or cryptocurrencies comes from the fact that groups of developers and miners in that ecosystem can't agree, and so they decide to go their separate ways.
It's fascinating how the evolution of technology kind of it evolves much like everything else. You have things that don't work well in one scenario, one goes one way, one goes the other way. You see that Ripple, Stellar, you see that Bitcoin Cash, you see that in a lot of tokens, but you also see that in architecture, hence hybrid systems. Some situations public chain technology works best, some private, so some mixed. And really, it depends upon not just the business objectives, but it is about somewhat to the philosophy of it, especially if you keep things in the public forum. This was originally designed to have less leniency on anybody but themselves. And that was the idea, to break away from any type of centralized control. And some people hold that to heart. Okay, that's fine. But at the end of the day, you still have to move forward.
Lucas Lehman.
The pace of innovation right now on the blockchain is both a blessing and a curse, I would say. And going back to Gerard's analogy of the internet in the early 90s, it's hard to forget the big dot-com bubble burst in the mid to late 90s. And some folks, economy professors, do believe we're approaching that with blockchain, where everyone is jumping in with 2 feet, but maybe not sure how to use it or if it's right for their business. And it does come back to this philosophical issue. What do you want to use the blockchain for? And when you ask a business that, they probably don't know. Yeah. They just hope it is some sort of panacea that will solve all your problems. But that's not necessarily going to be the case, but it definitely has tremendous promise.
And you know, an example of that is when Bitcoin first came out, right? You know, when the white paper came out, the early proponents thought this could really be everything. It could be a payment system. It could be a store of value. And as the technology progressed, right, they recognized the transactions are, while they're very secure, they're somewhat expensive, right? And so if the transaction fees are too high, then it might not make sense for you to use it to buy a cup of coffee at Starbucks. But it might be a great thing to do if you're going to be buying a house, right, or a car. And so that's one of the things, one of the splits came from, are we going to be a payment a system or are we going to be a store of value? And those are one of the other ones that Brennan mentioned was with Ethereum. There was a situation because of a bug in the system, there were people that lost a lot of money through no fault of anybody, right? And so they got together and some of them said, hey, listen, we ought to go back and fix this, right? Now, it's supposed to be immutable, but some of them said this immutability thing caused good people to get hurt. So that's something that caused another fork in that network.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. It's a look at an emerging distributed ledger technology, blockchain, and why enthusiasts say it's the beginning of a sea change in the way information and value is shared and transferred, and why UNCW CIE is dedicating an event to applications of this technology. Our three experts are answering your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138. Email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from the break, your questions and comments. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we're exploring the implications for an emerging platform called blockchain, which is penetrating financial institutions, colleges and universities, medical organizations, and governmental entities. With us to answer your questions on this Thursday, Gerard Dachet, president of the Government Blockchain Association, Lucas Lehman, assistant professor in UNCW's Department of Computer Science, and Brennan Bennett, chief operating officer of Qubrix. You can call us today at 910-343-1138 or email your question or comment to coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment on this Thursday, so just a few minutes left to get your question in. And I want to go to Nick's email because so much of this, the hype around blockchain is because advocates are calling this unhackable technology. And Nick writes, wasn't CoinRail out of South Korea just hacked? Where there's a will and millions of dollars, there's a way. And Gerard Dachet, you just talked about some issues with, was it Ethereum, the cryptocurrency, where there was a bug and some people lost some money. And of course, there was no, sort of nefarious intent there. It was a bug. But stuff is going to happen. Anything is hackable. There's nothing that's unhackable.
Well, yes and no. I know Brennan's got some points he wants to make. So let me just be brief and then turn it over to Brennan. You know, I like to bring the analogy back to the early days of the internet. We all had computers, and we turned them on, and we connected them to our modem, right? We heard the chee, ching, 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 right? And then what we said was, hey, I have a great idea. Let's reach out to somebody on the other side of the world and give them total unfettered access to our C drive. And we did that all the time until we realized, oops, that may not be a good idea, right? And then we developed security systems and protocols, and we got antivirus stuff and all that. And so we're kind of at the same place, right? It's a brand new technology. There are many vulnerabilities in the system. There are pieces that are totally unhackable, right? And there are pieces in that chain that are still very vulnerable. The bottom line is, if I'm a user of the system and I lose all my life savings, it doesn't really matter whether it's the blockchain or the access points, right? I've lost that money. So I think the reality is we've got to be very sensitive to the fact that there are real vulnerabilities that we've got to fix. We've got to close those holes. If we can close those vulnerabilities that exist, the rest of it is so secure that it is going to be a phenomenally secure system. But we're just not there yet.
Brennan Bennett.
So I want to add a few things to that. I do believe that there are vulnerabilities, but from the application level, CoinRail, the Ethereum DAO hack, all of the major hacks that hit the news repeatedly are at either the application level or they're on the exchanges, but they're not the protocols themselves. So being able to differentiate the security of moving money between applications, moving tokens between exchanges, I speak from personal experience, it can be vulnerable in a way that can be advantageous to people who want to steal it and take it elsewhere. That being said, there's also inherent vulnerabilities from a cybersecurity perspective. If we look at Moore's Law and the ability for computers to evolve over time, we're at also a new precipice of computer evolution in regards to quantum computing and the ability to process unbelievable amounts of information in very short periods of time and very concentrated doses. That will in effect have an effect on the security, the inherent what's called AES 256 security of most public ledger protocols. So we don't necessarily have to look at that today, but definitely have to keep that in mind for the near-term future, because computer science is evolving to the point where it can overtake some of these 51% hacks that people are scared about in the Bitcoin network. And we have to be cognizant of that, but at the same time, as Gerard had mentioned, kind of secured at the application level. The dollar hack that we had mentioned earlier in Ethereum, that was a third-party code bug. All of a sudden, 60 million was gone, just like that, from an application that was holding Ethereum, but not Ethereum itself. And it's important to differentiate that to not totally undermine trust in crypto as a whole.
So you're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Exactly. Yeah. As a whole, the science is sound. It just everything that comes along with it needs to be just as sound. And that's the problem when you have thousands and thousands of developers working on it. There's bound to be a bug somewhere.
Lucas Lehman.
Most of the vulnerabilities that we've seen in blockchain occur, as my fellows have said, at the edges, and where blockchain runs into traditional institutions. So for example, if you own Bitcoin, that's wonderful, but eventually you want that to be cash. So you have to cash it out, which means you have to go through a third-party broker. And maybe you have many other types of cryptocurrencies. And you don't want to carry around a big keychain, so you give that keychain to another person, and they are the ones that get hacked.
So and when you're talking about that keychain, you are talking about code.
Essentially, what I'm talking about is what's called a digital signature, right? So if you were to sign a contract, you would, at the bottom, write down your name. In blockchain world, you also have two digital signatures, in fact. And in the crypto world, in the blockchain world, these digital signatures are just really long strings of numbers, in fact, that are unique to you. And what you do is you give out one of those numbers to the whole world. And what the world does is they take that number and they kind of use it as a pair of goggles. And then anytime you sign a contract, you personally, you use another key. You use a different key. And then they look at it through their goggles and they say, aha, that is in fact Lucas Lehman who signed that contract. But if someone can get a hold of your pen that you use to sign your signature, you're in big trouble. And that's what's happened with these Ethereum hacks, with the Coinbase hacks, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's why there are now these companies that are creating bunkers around the world to hold computers that aren't connected to the internet but hold keys, these keys that you're talking about.
There's a huge amount of money value there, right? So just to give you an idea of how fast the value of this has grown, the market cap went from zero in 2008 to 2016 or 17, it was about $11 billion, right? A year later, it was around $600 billion. So when we're talking about these bunkers and these things that we have to do to secure these assets, we're literally talking about today hundreds of billions and soon trillions of dollars worth of value. And if you know what you're doing, if you practice safe computing, right, and you secure your keys and you don't do the things that would cause you to lose money in traditional technologies, right, you're fine. The technology is unbelievably secure.
But you're not saying, though, that these bunkers aren't necessary. I mean, billionaire investors who have bought.
I'm not saying. Everything is sort of it fits a risk profile. So, for example, I carry on my phone cryptocurrency, right, so that when I go to stores, like I use cryptocurrency in my daily activities. So I've got some cryptocurrency readily available here that, you know, I can use a Starbucks or a grocery store or whatever, right? But then again, if I had the kind of money you're talking about, I'd keep that in a vault, right, in an air-gapped system. So it really depends on, you know, how
your
secure
level of risk.
Your level of risk.
And let's not forget social engineering is front and center. I mean, they don't have to have access to your second key to get your money as long as they have access to your email to access the account that has access to your money.
Right.
And then it's just a matter of transfer and you're never getting it back.
And so if you have all of your money in that vault, but you give somebody your password, and they'll walk right in and take it.
And the biggest thing I see, stories I hear all the time in the crypto space is, for example, you build a wallet on bitcoin.info, whatever it is. You get a piece of paper with a QR code and your key on it. You download that file, it has the exact same name. If somebody cracks your computer and they do a quick control search for that file, and it doesn't matter how deep you hide it, and it's right then and there. So
if the file says Bitcoin wallet.
Which it does. Right? It literally does.
Are the safe computing things we're talking about, though. If you understand the technology, and so I would recommend anybody who's going to get in this space, get smart about how to secure it. And if you're smart about how to secure it, you're going to be fine.
You can always print stuff off, too.
We're talking about blockchain, the platform that underlies Bitcoin, but we're talking about applications that certainly go beyond cryptocurrency. Here to answer your questions on this Thursday, Gerard Daché, President of Government Blockchain Association, Brennan Bennett, Chief Operating Officer of Qubrix, and Lucas Lehman, Assistant Professor in UNCW's Department of Computer Science. If you have questions about this emerging technology, a few minutes left for you to call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Brian writes, I've noticed ever since Bitcoin has made its arrival, graphics cards have increased in price. Last time I tried purchasing a video card that was normally around $300 on an online computer parts site, it was listed for $800. I was told it was due to cryptocurrency. Can you please explain, Lucas Lehman?
So in public cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, the way that Bitcoin itself and the currency is created is not through some sort of printing treasury. It is given out as a reward for adding a block to the blockchain. To add a block to the blockchain, the peers in the blockchain need to solve a very, very hard math problem, even for a computer. And it turns out that graphics cards are very good at solving particular classes of math problems. So cryptocurrency miners have been buying up scores and scores of video cards and building systems, building entire warehouses, in order to try and solve the puzzle the fastest, because the first person to solve the puzzle and add the block to the chain gets the reward. And it's led to some very interesting scenarios in places where energy is cheap, like China. You have warehouses full of servers in there who all they are doing is trying to solve these puzzles and earn cryptocurrencies. And I think I read some estimate the other day that almost 32 terawatt hours of energy are being used to mine Bitcoin right now, which is enough to power the entire country of Denmark for an entire year. So it's a very interesting problem. But this mining process and the spending of money to acquire the systems and pay for your energy bill, that is the value that is actually being placed into Bitcoin. So it's at some point, the Bitcoin money is translated into actual dollars in the form of money.
I think it'll be interesting on how that will evolve. First of all, for proof of work for that particular model, you know, there will be a day where I don't want to say it's a thing of the past, but it will be a day where it's less relevant than it is today. I've seen I've seen rigs in Teslas before. I've seen people just absolutely come out of the most crazy ideas ever to get free energy or cheap energy in various parts of the world or countries. So what we'll see here, especially when, I mean, keep in mind, Bitcoin has a finite supply. It will stop necessarily being mined here relatively soon in the next couple of years. So that being on the onset of evolving past proof of work, evolving past the need for that, it's going to be kind of interesting how this dips off and how this kind of evolves from a space. NVIDIA, all the major graphics suppliers, they've seen massive sales for GPU processors. But, you know, this is an evolving space. This could pivot at any point, and I think it will. We'll start to see that once Bitcoin has been mined to its fullest.
Brennan Bennett, I just want to ask you about genomic data. That's another one of those pieces of value.
Can I just throw something? This mining space is, and energy and how to do it is a really, really big topic. If anybody wants specific information, if they go to the gbaglobal.org website, we have a mining working group.
Okay, and I will put the link to your website on our website with this
post as
well.
Because I know that's an area where people have a lot of questions.
We only have a few minutes left, so genomic data. Tell us why this might be a good platform for transferring that kind of information.
It's a phenomenal platform. There's several use cases here in the States and abroad that it's not necessarily about storing genomic data. It's about giving access and, for lack of a better term, renting or leasing your genomic data in an anonymized fashion, which goes all the way back to clinical trials and goes all the way, you know, to drug discovery. It can be used for a number of things, but we're seeing, at least I'm seeing in the healthcare space, the genomic data being able to be utilized for precision science, on-demand precision science, which is something of an evolutionary leap if you've ever experienced the U.S. healthcare system. So with that being said, it is crypto economic incentivization is part of what drives that, building an ecosystem where people are encouraged, incentivized to donate their genomic data to a database, and this cannot be done without artificial intelligence and machine learning. That is the backbone of being able to license this data, have researchers be allowed to use this data, but also for people to leverage this data that they already have to seek more advanced treatment.
So more advanced treatment, actually customized treatment, according
to you. When you have 10,000 people or more, in most cases, donating precise genomic profiles of themselves, but anonymized from an identification standpoint, you have really accurate data to be able to go after from a healthcare perspective, and that translates up and down the entire healthcare chain.
Healthcare applications are very interesting because it is one of those areas where blockchain is butting up against regulated industry. You know, mm-hmm. There are lots of privacy laws on the books, both here and abroad, that matter. Another area that is security is probably the primary use of blockchain, but those are regulated industries. The Securities Exchange Commission, the NASDAQ, uses blockchain for securities trading. Sweden land ownership is currently piloting a blockchain-based technology. So how disputes and resolutions will occur on blockchain trades will be very interesting in the future.
And just very briefly, some Oxford faculty members are imagining a different kind of university based on this technology where there's less risk that someone fakes a university a credential from a university they didn't graduate from, or if an institution goes out of business, they'll still have that credential in their blockchain. Gerard Dashé.
Yeah, it's called proof of ownership.
Brennan.
Yeah, I'll let Gerard speak to it, but proof of ownership allows the validity of passports, identification, government IDs, you name it.
Yeah, that asset, right? In fact, interestingly enough, I've received several emails in the last month asking, you know, offering to give me fake credentials and stuff. But I want to say one last thing. The genomic thing, the genomic marketplace is a phenomenal new innovation
and
in how that all works.
That's our time. That's this edition of Coastline. Thank you all so much for being with us today. Gerard Dashé, Lucas Lehman, Brennan Bennett, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the WHQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.